Perfect. Thank you very much for these three fascinating papers. I have two preliminary remarks, and then I will discuss the papers step by step. So actually, Ulrike borrowed this title of actors beyond the radar, or because, I mean, the impact of external influences were in almost all papers, so perhaps it makes more sense, or I'm very happy that we have two, or at least, actually three new dimensions now in this panel, because on the one hand we have the Chinese agency, we have the the Latin American agency, and we have some kind of more technical or the expertise dimension, I would call it. And the other preliminary remark is that we are highlighting agency, but I think it is also, it's also interesting and important to see or to learn something about modest influence. This is particularly true for Frank's talk, because, and you were already asking, does it matter? I mean, that does it matter at all? And I think yes, because for two reasons. Because on the one hand, you have illuminated difficulties of South-South relations at present. And on the other hand, we can also ask ourselves what kind of significance this kind of relationship might become in the future. And I will come back to this point later. So perhaps I will stay now at Frank's paper and begin with you. Actually, your presentation was quite different from your paper, so I really like this. And your presentation was as rich as your paper, so now I have two competing, not really competing visions, but additional accounts, and I try to make my best out of it. So, first point, I really liked it, I learned a lot, but I have some comments here. First comment would be, and this was interesting to see in your talk, because you changed the structure. My first comment was on the structure in your paper, because actually you was interested in the impact of South Atlantic relations on regionalism in Southern Africa, and to this end you first of all distinguished these three levels of cooperation, and then you went on to investigate in the facilitating conditions. And now you made it completely different, because you first of all talked about commonalities and then engaged in these more or less two levels, if I got it right, because you escaped the third one about bilateral, or at least structurally. So to my mind, these two dimensions were not strictly separated, or not strictly clear, at least in the paper. It was a little bit clearer now in the presentation, but I think it would be helpful really to differentiate between the questions why cooperation emerged South-South between South America and South Africa, and then to investigate how it took place, in which fora. You called it inter-regional portals. Yeah, I like that. I like it really, because that's exactly. And then go more into detail of these portals. So, and my next question, according to your paper, was why, I mean, your result was, okay, there was really a limited scope of mutual influence. And then, but then you talked in the paper about facilitating conditions, and I was wondering, why only talking about facilitating conditions? Why not only, why not also reflecting hampering conditions of this relationship? So in short, and perhaps in general, you have a lot of historical arguments in your paper. You put it a little bit aside in your presentation, but in your paper you really have a lot of historical arguments. For example, the strong relationship between Brazil and South America, and the shared history, a long shared history, starting with slavery and so on. And perhaps it would really also be helpful to start with an account of the history in a long durée, really going into, I don't know, the last three decades, because we are not, experts of this kind of relationships, and this would be really set the context for engaging in a more close context or conditions hampering as well as facilitating conditions since the 1950s. For example, I was wondering about the relationship. You put them together as, or one of your commonalities was that all these regions or these two regions were developing countries. But I was wondering what exactly was the relationship between South America and apartheid regime South Africa? I mean, this is really a difference, and they did not, were not part of, for example, of Bandung and all these developing interregional group of 77 and so on. You know this stuff better than me. Okay, this was on structure, and then actually your paper was a little bit more about the role of Brazil and South Africa in shaping interregionalism. And I think that's a very important dimension, perhaps. There you can focus on this question stronger, because one example why there's no more interregionalism out there, or not more interregional cooperation out there, is that the Latin American countries, except Brazil, are not interested in, because they don't have any historical connections. So perhaps you can get it closer to this question. And then I have some details, or some questions in details. You mentioned these portals, and I was wondering what's about this Africa-South America summit? Why was this forum launched, and for which purposes? To what extent do genuine interregional fora like this South Atlantic Zone of Peace and Cooperation, or the summit, act as places of socialization, for example, for people from Africa and Latin America to get used to work together? And most important for our purpose here, I think, is this question of Mercosur and SACU on the one hand, and Mercosur and SADC on the other. Why? How to explain this kind of variation? I mean, this is, I think, really the master question we have to tackle. And finally, how precisely does IPSA, you mentioned it, affect South African regionalisms? So you told us in the paper, at least, that it would underpin regional leadership, but I could also imagine that this kind of regional power collaboration hampered prospective integration steps. So, okay, I let it here and come to Daniela's paper, which I really liked for three reasons, because first of all, you brought the Chinese agency in. And secondly, you did this in a very, to my mind, in a very scientific and prosaic way, which is really welcomed as an alternative to public discourse on the allegedly bad neocolonial Chinese behavior and opposing the good European influence as good governance, for example, promoting good governance. And thirdly, because the question of normal diffusion is tackled from an African perspective, but that's also my first point, because we are here at a research college which is called the Transformative Power of Europe, or where the transformative power of Europe is claimed, if not granted. So my first question would be about your concept of norm diffusion. You completely ignored the sender's agency. And we have some mechanisms, you know, these mechanisms like coercion or conditionality, positive as well as negative incentives. And I have to ask you, or you have to explain me, why these sender strategies apparently does not play any role in your paper. Okay? Sender strategies, not agencies. Sender strategies. Why they? You mentioned it in your conclusion, but it's not part of your theoretical framework. And the second point concerns then models of your models of security and peace building, ranging from this traditional model to the more liberal model. Basically, a bias scheme, but. I think, to my mind, you applied in a too schematic way for 2 years. I mean, you already mentioned it, but I have two reasons why perhaps also it can be a little bit more complex, or it could be a little bit more complex. And the first is that you really downplayed a significant path dependency of the AU as successor of the organization, as successor organization of the OIU, because I would argue that there at least existed a genuine African understanding of international relations since the foundation of the OIU in 1963, which was very close to the Chinese model. So the AU's option for Chinese legacy, for the Chinese model seems less surprising if you have this historical dimension in mind. And secondly, second reason, I think most interesting are the cases where EU as well as AU deviate from their model. Yeah, you briefly mentioned these cases. And there I have a concrete question because it was not clear to me. Because you mentioned Darfur and Somalia were different as regards the EU behavior, and Somalia was the exception for the AU security doctrine. And if I got you right, I would like to hear more about why these kind of deviation emerged and how we can explain it, and perhaps we can you can make a really distinct category of analysis out of it, this dimension of inconsistency. And the last point, I think, yes, which is again very close to my historical argument. I think domestic interests and motives of the African governments are all too much neglected. I mean, it's completely clear that it's more the Chinese model is much more comfortable to deal with. Because the more fragile a state is, the less it is interested in foreign interference. And in this context, perhaps it's worthwhile to remind also a concept by African historian Ferry Cooper on the gatekeeper state, which says that the African states are weak and struggle to maintain control in the domestic sphere, for which reason they are so anxious to defend their sovereignty control in the vis-a-vis the international arena. So, these were the four points. So now I come finally on Bob's personal account, how to get the idea of regional social policy moving within African regional organizations, first of all, to say, well done, Bob, good job. Secondly, no, really, I'm very happy that you're with us here because you're a scientist as well as a genuine driver of emerging regional socialism. No, not regional socialism, but social regionalism. We have to delete this from the record. No, really. And thirdly, I particularly welcome your emphasis on experts and epistemic communities, and as well as on conflict between different international organizations, and finally, emphasis on contingency, as you presented us now, or these kind of accidents. I really like that. But having said this, I turn back to my role as a critical discussant, and I'm naturally deeply skeptical towards any personal account on how things happened as an historian. So that's, I hope I will get that. I stick to the time. I mean, in your presentation it was very clear, but in your paper I was a little bit skeptical towards your theoretical framework because you put the emphasis on individual agency. And I'm not sure if that's the point. The point in your case is rather, to my mind, this dimension of networking and advocacy coalitions, building advocacy coalitions. And I think you're absolutely right that also within networks, there are some people who are more important than others, but perhaps you can frame this within a overall network approach and do not put the emphasis on individual agency in the framework. That's the first point. Second point, you mentioned briefly also in your presentation the EU model of regional social policy. I was really surprised about to read that because as far as I know, there are some calls for such a policy within Europe, which in turn would tell me that we don't have it. And even you mentioned that this term is not much credit within the EU. I was a little bit confused since your ideas about regional policy are directed against a neoliberal world order. I mean, we can discuss what it means nowadays to talk about social democracy, but at least I was a little bit confused because to many observers, EU rather stabilizes or helps to stabilize the neoliberal paradigm. And that's why I would really like to know more about this European model of regional social policy. Okay, third point concerns the content of your idea. And there, perhaps it's worthwhile to repeat this UNDISA document, which guaranteed that regional social policy would not compete with national social policy. It would not compete with national social policy, according to this UNDISA document, and national sovereignty would not be restricted. Yeah, these are two. This document, which won through, I think. the UNDISA document, which was a splash. And I was asking myself which national social policy is referred to, because as far as I know, most of the countries do not have an adequate social policy on the national level. And my question would then be, where should the money come from in a purely African regional network? Yeah, that's question. Fourthly, is not so important. And finally, at the end of your paper, at least, I mean, you are absolutely right that the documents are out now, but we never know. We do not know what happens in reality or in practice. But actually, in your paper, you listed first achievements of regional social policy. And among them, agreements of cross-border movements of labor within ECOWAS, on the one side, and jurisdiction of the ECOWAS Court of Justice over national labor rights. And I was wondering, or I wasn't sure if these achievements are really in line with your ideas on regional social policy, because bearing the European experience in mind, as far as I know, the European Court of Justice was never credited for a distinct social jurisdiction in labor issues. So I don't know if this comparison fits to this concrete regulation as concerning the jurisdiction of the ECOWAS or this kind of development in ECOWAS. But perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about these first achievements and how they work, perhaps already in practice. And there I'm finished, and I'm off too long. I'm very sorry. Thanks.